Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Washington is reeling in the wake of Russia's unprecedented penetrations of the U.S. government, military, and industrial networks. American officials believe Russia's SVR, Foreign Intelligence Arm, spearheaded the attacks, penetrating an update to the SolarWinds software that many government and commercial organizations use. The Russians inserted their malicious code into the SolarWinds update that was downloaded by tens of thousands of users worldwide, giving the SVR persistent access to Pentagon, State Department, Homeland Security, Commerce, Treasury, Federal Reserve Board, CDC, as well as Energy Department being important that it oversees the nation's nuclear weapons development. The election security focus of the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, as well as NSA and U.S. Cyber Command, may have distracted officials from spotting the Russian operation that was very carefully conducted to avoid detection. The breach was so bad that very little information has been publicly released, and even retired senior cyber officials have been tapped to help. Senator Dick Durbin, the Michigan Democrat, has called it a declaration of war. Joining us today to discuss the attack, what it means, and how an incoming Biden administration must respond to improve the nation's cybersecurity, but also deal with Russia, are Dr. Jim Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who is one of the nation's leading cyber thinkers, and Michael Kaufman, who leads the Russia program at the Center for Naval Analyses, and he too is one of the nation's leading experts on Russia and the country's military. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report, and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems for our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA is our land warfare sponsor. Jim, talk to us about this. A lot of this is still very highly classified. We know that it's very, very bad. And the challenge is getting rid of the Russians from these systems, right? So this isn't sort of a days or weeks, but actually many months. Talk to us about what's going on right now, the magnitude of this, and how people ought to be wrapping their minds around it, because this is going to be a crisis that we're going to be living with for a long time.
This was a triumph for the Russians. I mean, you don't get onto at least 18,000 people's networks and sit there for at least 6 months without being able to gain tremendous insight. And of course, as you've said, the question is, what did they leave behind? It will take us weeks, probably months, to sort it all out, figure out what the problems are, what the Russians have done. So this was really, you know, I hope whoever did it gets a medal, because it was a great job. But it is a huge blow to the U.S. when it comes to intelligence. And the problem isn't the fact that they got in using solar waves. The problem is we don't know if we've gotten them out.
And obviously, that's something that's going to take time, right? I mean, they're still in these networks, right?
Yeah, I think some of the cybersecurity companies have started to offer tools to help people find and remove these things. But we know from previous experience that this is a long process. And in the past, the Russians have been good at gaining access and then hiding themselves in a way that makes it difficult to get them out. So it could be months. You could easily sit dormant and then be triggered, come back to life, you know, 3 months from now. So it'll be a while.
Michael, the Russians always have a plan. Why did they do what they did and when they did it?
Well, it's a very good question on when they did it, because we don't actually know when they did it, right? We're assuming that this started as far back in the spring. And one of the more interesting things about the revelations regarding this hack is that it wasn't the United States government that I think first released information. It was FireEye and the media. And so it was undoubtedly discovered through some specific revelatory mishap on their part, but I don't think that they intended for us to necessarily find out at the specific time. And this hack is still ongoing. As my colleague CSIS said, they're still in these systems. We don't know how many systems they're involved in. Why do they do it? Well, that's straightforward. This is a classical case of cyber espionage. They've done something like this back in 2015, and they do it all the time. Although we may be used to stories of sort of bumbling GRU agents trying to assassinate this person or trying to conduct this sort of brute force attack, people often forget that the SVR, which is a different foreign intelligence service, is very good, very subtle, and quite effective, right? And they've done this before, and here they've come back to do it again. This is a job of an intelligence organization that's quite good at penetration, data exfiltration, at a cyber espionage. And the extent of the damage and what they can use the information for down the line still remains to be ascertained. We don't know. But the short answer is that this is actually, unfortunately, as much as it may be a bitter pill to swallow for people, fairly traditional cyber espionage in contemporary form.
So, Jim, carrying on with this, that this is sort of business as usual for the Russians, and this is the sort of thing that they do. The New York Times reported very expertly about the Einstein Network, the tens of billions of dollars invested in cyber defense and security. We have NSPD 13, the National Security Presidential Directive 13 that did Defend Forward, which is what the NSA and U.S. Cyber Command have been focused on. And apparently, neither of them worked, right? So, architecturally, what does the Biden administration have to do vis-a-vis cyber? And is this something that's a money problem, a focus problem? What has to happen to stop these kinds of breaches from happening? Because if the Russians did it, clearly the Chinese absconded with enormous amounts of not just intellectual property, but right, there were the OPM hacks and the hotel hacks, right? All personal information that could be a great source of blackmail. How does the Biden administration need to respond and be thinking about when it enters office when it comes to cyber?
Well, it needs to do three things. It might need to think about either an update or a new executive order that requires agencies to think about how they use managed services, and that requires the agencies with regulatory authority to get their customers to look at how they use managed services, how they take advantage of the cloud. These are things that we've sort of done on an ad hoc basis, but if you think about the NIST framework, it probably needs to be extended. So that would be a good first step. The good news is you could do that relatively quickly. I wouldn't wait for legislation. That's probably not going to happen, but start telling people we're in a different digital environment than we were in 2015. You need to adjust your rules and your thinking to do that. The second thing they need to do is they need to think about how we work with our allies and partners in responding to these sorts of aggressive actions. There's an interest in building an alliance. There's an interest in Europe and in Japan in working with us on cyber issues. You saw a joint statement last year at the end of the UN General Assembly. So that's another easy one for the Biden administration, because I think it's pushing on an open door. People want to figure out a way to create some kind of cooperative approach to dealing with cyber aggression. And so that's one they can pick up right away. The harder one, and the third one they need to do, is you need to change the calculations of the Russians and the Chinese about the risks of taking actions against the U.S. My impression is they've lost respect for us in both cases. They don't feel that there's much risk. I mean, people talk about deterrence. I think that's a form of ancestor worship. They're clearly not deterred. So you could say, well, maybe we need to think how to rebuild deterrence, but at a minimum, we need to communicate with them that you can't do this with impunity. And that means probably taking some kind of action against them. Not more sanctions. Every sanction known to man has already been applied to the Russians. Not indictments. Indictments are a lot of fun, but it won't stop them. But probably some kind of forceful action in cyberspace. And that will take a while to sort out. How do we do that? What are the rules? How do we work with our allies to do this? So there's three things they could do. Two are easy, one is hard, but they're going to have to do them.
I'm going to come back to you on that in a minute. But Michael, how does the new administration need to respond? Need to respond before January 20 and need to respond afterwards, right? I mean, Jim brings up an excellent point that Russia is very, very brazen and will take advantage of every situation. It's very Soviet in a lot of ways. How does the United States have to respond to this, given the magnitude of what's happened?
And the U.S. just has to be much more effective in defending its own defense enterprise and intelligence networks. And There are people that are crying for response to this, but look, I gotta be frank here. It's not a cyber attack. Nothing was denied, degraded, or destroyed, and nobody was injured. This is cyber espionage, and some of these people, the way they talk about it, they need to like breathe into a paper bag or something, because it's just not the case. In terms of cyber deterrence, it is completely ineffective here. I think James is absolutely right. You cannot deter cyber espionage, almost by definition. U.S. sort of defense forward posture in the cyberspace, I think, has principally two components. One is sharing more with allies and improving resilience. And the second one is sort of preemptive cyber hacking of Russian offensive cyber means to deter specific things or to prevent them from engaging in, let's say, cyber meddling in U.S. elections or actions of that type. And the extent to which it's been effective is debatable, but that is really neither here nor there to this form of cyber hack. And I don't think we're going to be able to address a cyber hack in deterrence. And that I completely agree. Question is, what should the administration do? Most of that is on the defensive side and is on questions pertaining to how we actually manage the defense enterprise to prevent these sort of attacks from being as devastating, from being recurring, and from having this wide reach. You're not going to stop them. Retaliating against Russia, you're not even really clear what that looks like. We engage in cyber espionage against Russia all the time, every day. So I'm not sure what you're going to do now that you weren't doing yesterday. That's almost a mystery to me. It's neither here nor there. I understand that there's undoubtedly some public outcry and political desire to do more, but much of what has to be done is actually on the U.S. side of things.
It's interesting what Michael is saying, right, in making that distinction that this was an intelligence operation and these two nations have been spying against one another for a very, very long time. Imperial Russia was spying on America, just like America was spying on Imperial Russia, right? So, I mean, we've gone through many generations of this at the end of the day. Tom Bossert wrote that all options are on the table. People have a tendency of thinking that that's also military action. Do we need some form of declaratory policy at this point, or is this kind of a gray zone area where you just didn't defend well enough? I was smart enough and I penetrated your network.
Great powers play by different rules, and we have a declaratory policy. It's on page 11 of one of the earlier national cyber strategies. It's a whole paragraph long. It's filled with caveats. You know, when the moon is full, when the conditions are right, the president can do X or Y. I've asked both Russian and Chinese interlocutors, hey, do you guys know we have a declaratory policy? And they say, no, they don't know, right? Because it's so vague. So if we do a declaratory policy, it would have to be a lot clearer, a lot more forceful. The other thing is, if you want to use from a phrase from the nuclear age, credibility. We're just not credible anymore. And that's where I'm going to disagree a little bit. We are going to need to take some kind of action. Now, that will go beyond the sort of legal things we've done. It has to. What it looks like with Defend Forward, I don't know. It would be normal to, you know, throw out the ambassador or close some consulates, but you have to take some kind of response. You have to take some kind of action if you want these things to tamp down. The way you draw lines in cyberspace is through action, not through newspaper articles or notes from the embassy. So I'm kind of with Tom on this one. Nothing should be off the table, and we need to tell the Russians that nothing is off the table.
Michael, you know, at the end of the day, you know, at the Halifax International Security Forum, Justin Trudeau had a great message that, you know, China does what it does. I mean, he didn't say specifically, but countries like China and Russia do what they do because they get away with it and they don't get called on the carpet. The United States has some pretty formidable intelligence capabilities as well. And given that this has already happened a couple of times, doesn't it make sense for the United States to abscond with some highly classified Russian information and regularly make it available to humiliate Putin, for example, bank account records, relationships, organized crime links, and things like that? I mean, right at the end of the day, the Russians do understand force, and you hit them enough times in the head, even the hardest head finally starts going, man, that's annoying.
Yeah, I see what you're saying here, Vago. I hate to be kind of a Debbie Downer here, so I'm going to say two things. The first is, I believe we are doing that in terms of cyber espionage. And then second, the Russians believe that we are personally hacking and stealing information regarding to the regime that's embarrassing to them and leaking it to the media because they think that we actually control the media and that we're releasing this. And it happens quite a bit in discussions with them. So they're long past their own belief that this is one of the main vectors of U.S. strategy aimed at Russia. It's hard to already do on top of what your adversary thinks you're already doing. The challenge with all this is that deterrence in cyberspace is just not very effective. When you say things like all options are on the table, nobody believes you because they are not, okay? Because cyber attacks are different from kinetic attacks, and nobody was injured in this attack, and nothing was destroyed in this attack either. It's not really an attack in that sense, or at least it hasn't been yet, all right? And I'll be honest, we have studies on this. Right, the declaratory policy, it's really interesting for allies, but your adversaries don't believe it's you, and it's so ambiguous, and you have all sorts of promises there that you're not going to carry through. You're not going to retaliate for this. It's very clear to them. And some of you will say, well, we should. And my question is, should we, though? Are you sure that this is really a cyber attack with injury to the United States and not a fairly rogue case of cyber espionage? It's a very vast one. It's an embarrassing one, admittedly. But I just don't think that the U.S. is going to have good forward-leaning responses to us. It's welcome to engage them and try it, but Defense Forward already does that. So in any case, I know that this is not necessarily a popular position or opinion to make here, Vago. I'm just right now skeptical about the efficacy of U.S. declaratory policy or about sort of shaking your fist while the adversary knows for a fact that you're actually not going to do much about it. And the things that you do threaten to do, they already believe that you're doing it.
Jim, does this drive sort of building a little bit on Michael's point? And Michael, you're not unpopular in saying it, right? I mean, I think the reason we're having this conversation is how is it we should be looking at it? I do. I'm closer to Jim's position on this. This is the sort of the breach that is significant enough that when caught, you're compelled to do something about it. On the other hand, I do see the point that this was an espionage operation. And this is a little bit akin to what a Chinese official once told me. He said, if these intellectual property was, your secrets were important to you, surely you'd defend them better than you did, right? So, I mean, you can argue, if I can get in your networks, I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't getting into your networks, right? Jim, so does this, right? We just spoke to Admiral Mike Rogers. He was our guest on our strategy program just a week ago. And one of the things that he said was, this notion that we didn't want to be more muscular in our responses, in part because of our view that we live in a glass house. Does this drive the Biden administration back to a more cautious, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones approach? Or does that drive something maybe more muscular in response?
Hey, that worked so well for the Obama administration. Boy, I think we're long past the days where we need to be timid. And if we want to continue to lose, we should continue to be timid. Michael's right. We don't have a good menu of options. We have to think what that would look like. And that probably means, you've heard other people say this, there's precedents from the experience of Task Force Ares, there's precedence from the Cyber Command actions with the midterms. The British are doing things that are a little more aggressive than we are in some areas. So we're going to have to map this out. But, I don't worry about living in a glass house because, one, everyone is now dependent on the internet, the Russians as much as we are. And so if we're worried about them doing something to us, we need to make them worry about us doing something to them. And it's got to go beyond saying tisk tisk or saying we have a declaratory policy. There's risk in that, and we have not thought our way through it, but I think that's what we need to do.
Jim, I know that you've got to go in a minute, so let me ask a double question, and then I want to talk to Michael a little bit about U.S.-Russia strategy and maybe the way the Biden administration should be approaching this. Do you think that last year when John Bolton made some public statements about how the United States had installed cyber weapons in Russia's networks, effectively sort of gloating, and it was regarded at the time as valuable messaging, right, that you're vulnerable. You and I spoke after that, and I wrote an editorial where it was like, hey, look, be careful who you pick fights with, especially when your own house is in order, is not in order, that you're not as, as secure. Is it a potential link between those two?
I don't think so. Remember, the Russians have Edward Snowden living at the bottom of a coal mine, and whether he may not have intended to cooperate in telling them this stuff, but they certainly learned a lot from him. So no surprise to them. It's been in the New York Times. When you look at, they put some of the places where we have access points in Russia. As Michael said, the Russians already assume that we're doing all this. We need to think, though, are the old rules that applied to the intelligence game still appropriate for cyberspace? And I would say no. Bolton, you know, if you were going to be critical of Bolton and Trump, it's that they entirely disrupted the process we had for a coordinated response in cyberspace by getting rid of Tom Bossert and Rob Joyce. And honestly, they gave Russia a kind of a pass on some of this stuff. So the Russians, when you talk, and you've had this experience too, when you talk to the Russians and the Chinese, they assume we're doing everything we can in intelligence, but they also assume that we'll be afraid to do anything coercive.
Jim, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Hope you and yours have great holidays and a happy new year, and looking forward to having you back on in 2021.
You too. Talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Good talking to you, Michael.
Michael, let me get your sense on how the Biden administration needs to look at Russia writ large strategically, right? Tensions are still running high between the countries. Now this action is on top of it. The president-elect has been very clear that he's going to be tougher and more organized in the approach to Russia, right? I mean, the big concern was that while the Trump administration did talk tough and was tough in some respects on Russia, the president of the United States was somewhat less tough on Russia. And at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin responds to how the leader responds, not to how the team responds at the end of the day. What do you think this administration has to bear in mind when it takes office?
I think they have to bear in mind that Russia is an enduring competitor and a challenge for the United States. It's not going to go away. You know, the national security community has a real case of Russia declinism, all right? Successive Secretary of Defense have believed that Russia is a threat now, but will be a lesser threat down the line. And it's really not clear why or if anyone has consulted the Russians on this plan, but I don't believe that's remotely true. Russia is not a leading priority for the incoming Biden administration. But they have to keep in mind, and this hacking event is an important example of this problem, that Russia gets a significant vote where it's going to be on the priority list. It's not solely in the hands of the people that are going to write the next national defense strategy. Okay? And Russia has a tendency to really place itself on the rear. So when we look at this, it's important to take Russia seriously. Russia is a different type of competitor and challenge than China. It is not a much lesser version of the challenge we face with China. And Russia is not going to go away. It's not going to run out of money. It's not going to run out of people. It's not going to stop doing things like this. It's going to be there. And you really need to commit the people and the resources to dealing with this problem set. I hope this is a useful reminder once again for people. And part of the reason I say that is because I know there's a tendency in some national security circles, which I will mention, to believe that Russia's had a bad year, that Vladimir Putin's on the ropes, you know, he's COVID's really affected the economy. Belarus and Lukashenko is a problem, this, that, and the other. Now, Russia's going to look for a way out of some of the strategic mishaps it's had in the last 6 years. And I'm going to tell you that that is completely delusional. None of it is true. That is not what's going to happen in U.S.-Russia relations. And it's not the way Russia looks at it. Russia can sustain this confrontation, is a much more resilient power than people give it credit for, surprisingly, and that there needs to be a genuine Russia strategy. And there need to be real resources placed against this Russia strategy. And that China does belong at the top of the U.S. priority list, okay? But Russia should not be dismissed from the great power competition or ignored or underestimated, right? And this is a reminder of that fact.
I think that that's a great point, Michael, right? And, you know, you were on just a couple of weeks ago, as I recall, both once with Gene Roemer and another time with your colleague, Sam Bendett. And we sort of discussed this a little bit, right? That there's this tense sense of, you know, Russia's is a declining power and they're demographically doomed. And you know, it's still a giant country with enormous natural resources and tremendous intellectual wealth, and it is a great power. And so it's going to throw that weight around and maybe a little bit less constrained than I think democracies find themselves being constrained. Do you think, though, that there is a way for the United States to work more closely with its allies, you know, as Joe Biden says, to build this sort of Congress of democracies, to work in a more concerted fashion, to put pressure against those who violate international norms? I mean, yeah, I understand that Russia is a great power and it can exercise its muscle. It also is a great power that has a tendency of assassinating people all over the world. And we think that the death rates are actually remarkably higher than the individual Skripal event or the Navalny recent assassination attempt, that actually some of them are serious and actually succeed, that don't involve, for example, nuclear poisons, but people shooting themselves in the head with rifles that are a mile away. I mean, at the end of the day, do you think that by bringing countries together, there's a way to exert any form of meaningful pressure on Russia? Or is Russia going to behave and continue to behave the way it behaves as long as Vladimir Putin and his cronies are in power?
Well, I think it's important to look past Vladimir Putin and ask big, profound questions about whether the United States has a Russia problem or a Vladimir Putin problem. Leaders matter. What leaders think absolutely matters. But it would be somewhat fantastical and delusional to believe the United States is going to have a tremendous realignment of sort of views, values, and interests with either a regime that follows Vladimir Putin's regime or a different leader that largely kind of continues along a similar regime path. I think there's plenty the United States can do. In fact, let's be frank, the United States is doing quite a bit already. The U.S. has an active pressure campaign. It has a strategy of exhaustion aimed at Russia's economy. It has a pretty good theory of victory in terms of deterrence and defense in Europe. It can do far more with allies, not just in style and tenor. That is, we're not just going to go back and reassure allies under the Biden administration compared to the way Trump was treating them. But it can do a lot more in terms of collective action, getting policy aligned with Europe, getting Europe on board and NATO on board with collective action to both constrain Russian capacity to effectively deter Russia by punishing them when they do things we don't want them to do, but also messaging them clearly, all right, that this punishment is not part of some existential confrontation, right? That they have ways out. They have off ramps that we want them to take, that we're not just going to keep pushing that button to hurt them and to voice our displeasure. And, you know, of course, at the end of the day, the U.S. has a tremendous amount that it can do vis-a-vis its allies when it looks to long term, because in the last 4 years, the U.S. spent a lot of time, we'll call it hard bargaining, but what it really was is in some ways coercing its own allies and threatening or actually sanctioning its own allies as part of the fight with Russia. And that gets you nowhere. That gets you absolutely nowhere down the line. I mean, it gets you short-term results, but it gets you big long-term losses. So if you have kind of the art of the long view, you have to think about how essential your allies are to your coercive power in international politics and what you can do to Russia and how you can contain Russia and constrain it.
Michael, thanks very much for joining us. Hope you and yours have great holidays. Happy New Year. And look forward to having you back on in 2021. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on your program.
Always a pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.